Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Spring in Vermont lasts all of about 3 weeks, and thank goodness, because after our long winters with trees standing as bare stick figures for almost 6 months, it's a glorious sight to see them resplendent in shining shades of green. And while three-fourths of our state is blanketed in forests, it's quite easy to take the trees for granted and to never really understand what trees go through in the course of a year, how they support so much insect, aviary, and wildlife. Today, we take a closer look at what's going on in the woods and get a better understanding of our trees. Here to guide us through the forest for a closer inspection of the trees are Alexandra Kusiba, Research Project Coordinator for the Forest Ecosystem Monitoring Cooperative and a scientist at UVM, and Michael Snyder, Commissioner of Vermont's Forest, Parks, and Recreation Department, and he's the author of the new book, Woodswise, An Exploration of Forests and Forestry. I want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Ali Kusiba, what is so fascinating about trees that most of us aren't aware of?
Oh, there's so many things that are pretty amazing about trees. We think about them. We think about sitting under their shade, their beauty, their maple syrup. But that really misses a lot of the services that they provide us and wildlife, insects. So we think about the food that they support, caterpillars in the leaves, or bark that a porcupine eats. They are homes to bears and birds and pileated woodpeckers, squirrels, so many number of things. And then we forget about the benefits that they provide the ecosystem. So pulling up water deep in the soil, stopping erosion when we get really big downpours, cooling the soil from solar glare that happens, all sorts of things that really are vitally important for our state here and for our world.
Michael Snyder, what led you to pursue a career of understanding and protecting trees?
Well, that goes way back. When I was a kid, I just really liked being outside and was raised in a family that had, I think, abiding respect for biology and life and study of it. And again, it was really about being outside and then meeting a forester when I was a young boy, about the time when I realized that I guess you have to grow up and have a job someday, and thinking, you mean you can do that? I think I want to do that. And really, ever since, that was like elementary school. Just this, I just loved climbing trees. It's really where it started, being outside as a little boy, and then pursuing it as a profession, even through high school and college. And every step of the way, it's just been great. As Ali says, there's so much to trees and the forests that they create. And it's been a heck of a ride.
And you prefer the term woods over forests. Why is that?
Well, I do. And I appreciate the question, because I think there is a real distinction in my mind. I love forests, and I think of forests as kind of an academic notion. They're complex and big and vast. And whereas woods are more familiar, they're parts of the forest that we might know. And to me, that's the distinction, is the woods are more familiar, more friendly, and where you're at home, a forest is bigger and maybe a bit more complex and a lot to handle. Woods are kind of bite-sized pieces.
Yeah. Ali, we're going to climb trees today, figuratively. But let's start with the part we don't see, the roots. Mm-hmm. What's happening down there beneath the soil?
Well, when you look at a tree, we're just seeing the trunk of it, the branches, the leaves, and most people think that the mirror image applies to the roots, that the roots are spreading down just like the branches, but that isn't true. The crown is actually somewhat compact because those leaves are competing for sunlight. Whereas the roots are not competing for sunlight, so they'll spread often, way beyond the farthest reaches of the leaves, so it's often 100 feet, and they'll intermingle with other roots around them. And they'll even, we found out, graft. So that means that the roots are actually attaching attaching to each other. So one tree's roots will actually attach to another tree's roots. They can be the same species or even a cross species. And we've seen this can be really beneficial for trees. They can share nutrients, water in times of stress. It can also mean that's how diseases get passed. So Dutch elm disease that affects American elms actually can get passed through these root grafts when the trees are growing close. So it can be a vulnerability, but also this amazing process where the where bigger trees that have a lot of resources can support smaller trees in times of stress.
Wow, that's incredible. Now, I'm just going to ask this. You're going to, as a scientist, probably say, no. But the Dutch elm disease would only spread with another elm, but if it's grafted to a maple, it wouldn't pass the disease to a maple. Is that correct?
Correct. And we've seen that you might have seen elm that survive out in fields and things like that. And that's because they're so far away from another elm that they are not able to graft roots. So we really saw this where elms are planted quite closely, their roots are grafted. And unfortunately, that was problematic for the elm.
How are our elms doing in Vermont? Do we have any left?
We do. And it's not hard to find them, traveling about. It's easy to find them as they stand out in summertime as the dead ones or dying ones. That said, there are some, as Ali said, that have escaped infection. It's a fungus that really causes the disease. It's spread by an insect. This is where these complex arrangements begin to emerge. And similarly, when trees are far apart from a known infection, it can be hard for the insect to find a new host tree. And so that tree escapes infection for some time, either by root grafting or by dissemination by the insect. So accordingly, after this widespread wave of mortality, there are lingering elm trees that are in various stages of growth and death.
Mm. Michael, because we're so short in comparison to most trees, most of what we spy at eye level are the tree trunks. So let's go there. Is this where all the activity of getting nutrients from the soil up to the branches and leaves happens? What's going on in that trunk of the tree?
An awful lot. And especially when you consider, for the most part, that stem, the trunk of the tree, is predominantly made of dead tissue. It's non-living. There's a thin veil of living cells known as the cambium under the bark and some cells related, but there's an awful lot inside the tree. There's wood or dead xylem cells, and yet there's an amazing amount that goes on. As you say, it's the connection between this vast underground ecosystem and what we see above in the branches and kind of the business end that we know of where leaves photosynthesize. The stems are this kind of vasculature, like if you think similar to our system of veins and arteries, it's the plumbing system for a tree, connecting those tiny root hairs at the ends of each root that are absorbing water from the soil, and it's being pulled all the way up, in our case, 100 feet in the biggest trees, several hundred feet up into the very tips of the leaves. That's water with dissolved nutrients from the soil, and that's the lesser known ingredient in photosynthesis. We give the sunshine a lot of credit for
right.
this and the leaves' ability to do that, but they can't do it without pulling those resources from the soil. And that is all happening in the what's known as the phloem, or the inner bark, and the sapwood of the xylem, and that's the actively conducting tissues within the tree.
The trunk is where we see the rings of the tree, Ali. We know that can tell us a tree's age, but what else can we learn from those rings and that trunk?
So every year a tree is putting on new wood in that ring that Mike just talked about. So we have seasons here in Vermont. So the tree shuts down in the fall, winter, it stops growing. Come spring, it starts putting on cells to get wider and wider. And because of that seasonality, we can look at the width of those rings and it tells us how favorable the conditions were for that tree to grow in at that location. So this is a great record. If you think about how long a tree can live around here, we have trees that live hundreds of years old. That means that they have a record of the climactic conditions, environmental conditions, where they grew. So we might see a tiny ring, a very small ring, where a few cells of wood were put on when there was a drought, or maybe an insect outbreak that ate all the leaves on that tree. And then another year that's really wide because we had a great growing season and ample moisture and good sun. So we can look back and compare the width of those rings to climate and see what that tree responded to. Also helps us forecast for how that tree will grow in the future under climate change.
Listeners, you can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. We've got Brian calling from Montreal. Brian, thanks for joining us. What's your question today?
My question is based on my work experience. I all my life as an engineer, I made it my business to know about wood and wood resources and how to use it most effectively. It ended up 1 year of my life, I was the guy in part of northern British Columbia responsible for all the roads and bridges, taking all the foresters and all the forest trucks in and out of a monster northern boreal forest. And what made me clear to me there was everybody that I communicated with in that northern place knew about the forest and knew its, how it worked in their own detailed way, and they cared intensely about it because their lives depended on it. Have you any idea if that's ever the case in northeastern forests? Because your forest is a hardwood forest, but it's fascinating in its own ways. Personally, for example, I wish I'd invested in land where small hardwood trees were just growing up, and I depended on the success of those trees maturing to harvest size by the time of my retirement. Now that I'm 70, it's too late to do it. Why isn't that part of America's perspective on the forest, or is it?
All right, let me ask both of our guests here. Do we have an understanding, do we have an appreciation of forests here in the Northeast, in Vermont? Michael, what do you see in your role?
Well, it's a wonderful question and observation, and I'd like to say yes, for sure. That's, as you introduced, Rick, it's easy to kind of take this great green expanse for granted and miss these trees. But I think that does happen to some extent, but at the same time, we have a very rich heritage of what we call a working landscape of farms and actively managed forests, and that continues. And it's really important here. And I think increasingly we see a growing awareness of a reawakening to the importance of forests and the role of good forestry in keeping forests healthy and productive and supplying the vast array of goods and services that we humans absolutely depend on. And I think we do have that still, at least some connection to the land. I think it's a concern that it's slipping, this awareness of our connection to the woods. And as I think of as a close, careful, intelligent, peaceful, productive coexistence with trees. That's what forestry is, and we have a rich heritage of that here. But I'll leave it there.
Allie, what do you see, and do you do outreach so people do have a better appreciation and understanding of the trees and the forests?
I agree with what Mike said. I do think we have a really rich history of using the forest in New England and a lot of private family forests. And I see an increase in recent years of using local wood products, which I think is really important too. We have a great resource here in New England, and often we are exporting materials elsewhere. And so using the materials that we have not only with hardwoods, but we have softwoods. We have great building materials here. Biomass is increasing in popularity, which is a great use of products. Firewood, a lot of folks still use that to heat their homes, me included. So I think that it's changed a lot over the decades. We're now finally seeing a decrease in the forest cover, and I think people are learning to not take forest cover for granted, that we could lose that identity that we have in New England if we lose the forest cover.
We talked about elms, and now David in St. Johnsbury has an elm question. David, thanks for calling. What's your question?
I have a 15-acre woodlot, more or less, and about a dozen elms scattered around, a couple of them close to my house. They're about 4 to 5 inches through, breast high, and I wonder if there's anything I can do to encourage their growth. I'm very careful about not cutting anything near them and leaving them alone. But is there anything I can do to encourage their growth?
Well, I appreciate your concern for that, and I'd say the best thing you can do is to, you know, give them everything else possible. It's not really possible to protect them from the fungus or the insect that vectors that fungus that causes the vascular disease. But if it's practical for you and you can water them in times of drought, that will help. Anything you can do to help their vigor and promote their general condition otherwise will help, including if you're doing any pruning or cutting to sterilize your tools before touching another tree and to burn the cuttings quickly, because that can sterilize the tools and the site from the inoculum of the fungus.
We got this email from Jerry, who writes, "The progression of tree decline and death that has concerned and alarmed me for the past 50 years is now picking up speed. We may have reached an environmental tipping point. The proximate cause of most of the widespread dying of the white pines is needle cast, which never used to be fatal or widespread." The following excerpt from my ecosystems.org website is the most logical conclusion I can come to. He writes, "Forests are losing vigor, becoming more stressed, and are increasingly dying across broad geographical regions. In many cases, long-term exposure to air pollution and air pollution-induced climate change are the underlying reasons ecosystems are severely stressed and trees are dead and dying." Allie, how concerned should we be about the future of trees because of the stresses that Jerry brings up?
Oh, those are great points, Jerry. When we think about a tree, we have to think about what conditions was that tree adapted to grow in. So we call that the climate envelope. So there might be a range of conditions that that tree has withstood over the years. We have high temperatures, low temperatures, ranges in precipitation. But as soon as those climactic conditions go outside that climate envelope, that tree will be stressed because it will not be able to withstand those changes. And as Jerry pointed out, we have this interactive effect where diseases and insects that affect trees may change their patterns with climate change. So we're seeing this with white pine needle disease. We're having wetter spring conditions that is promoting the fungal outbreak. This is true also with some insects, where we just have conditions that can change their life cycles. It's happening out in the western United States too with bark beetles. So it is a really big problem, and we are studying those relationships between climate change and tree growth and those insect pest outbreaks as well. So disentangling those relationships is vital for knowing how the forest will look in the future.
Michael, let's talk maples for a little bit because, you know, it is our kind of iconic tree. So many people love them, are concerned about them because of the sap and the syrup. Is there a right or wrong, a good or bad time to tap a maple?
Sure. You know, and to your point, I mean, one in every four trees in Vermont is a maple.
Wow.
So it's a good question, and we do care for a lot of reasons, well beyond maple syrup and the other maple products. It's just such an important tree. I like to start by saying any tree is better off without a hole in it. Yet that said, maple trees are really good at putting up with holes, something we refer to as compartmentalization within the stem to kind of wall off that injury to keep it from spreading or other organisms from invading. So we're really lucky and much better than many other species could do with that. Mm-hmm. That said, again, they'd rather not have a hole, I suppose you could say. But if you do put a hole in, from our perspective, the best time would be if you're doing so to gather sap. You do it right before the big gusher, and mm-hmm. nobody knows when that is. So, and in particularly on large scale operations, I think earlier and earlier, particularly given the closed systems now of plastic tap spouts and tubing, there's less chance for what was known as drying out or some contamination. And so I think earlier and earlier in January, you're seeing sugar makers tapping in to be ready for a big run and hoping to capture all of them. That said, also doing it in winter when the tree is otherwise basically dormant, not growing, but alive and metabolizing, less chance for things to go wrong there as well, as opposed to tapping it in the summertime when you wouldn't get any sap anyway.
Right. And how about these vacuum pumps that a lot of the sugar makers are using? What effect are they having on these maple trees?
Well, it's really simple physics that helps increase the gradient between the pressure inside the stem and outside atmospheric pressure that helps sap flow. And really that's the long and short of it, though folks would be naturally concerned that are we pulling stuff out of the tree in a bad way. And that there's some really interesting research done at the Proctor Maple Research Center at UVM. The late Maria Franca Morselli, I think, did a lot of work on this and examining the sap that under vacuum and finding that there were no cell constituents. There's no tree parts other than the sap in the sap. So whereas there was some concern that the vacuum was pulling things out of the tree that needed to stay in the tree, there's really no evidence of that. And hundreds of years of tapping maples seems to bear it out that they can put up with this.
Let's go back to the phones. We have another call from Peter in Brattleboro. Peter, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I would just want to make a comment. It's so far nobody has made has mentioned the fact that trees process the carbon in the atmosphere, and that's extremely important for the air's breathability in view of our global warming situation.
That's a great point, Peter. As a matter of fact, I just saw an article in London. They put this park bench up, and it says that this will do the work of 250 trees in removing carbon from the atmosphere. And it made me think, trees do that every single day. Like, we don't have to put anything up. We could just put up 250 more trees, or you know, plant 250 more trees. But to his point, I mean, we haven't gotten to all the things yet that trees do, but talk about how, you know, trees do absolutely that for us.
Right, so they are taking in carbon dioxide in their from their leaves. So there's little holes on their leaves called stomata, and carbon dioxide enters there, and through, you know, complex cellular processes, it gets turned into wood. Is really a big building block for the tree, right? To get taller, to get stronger, to reach that sunlight. It's then used for other processes and metabolism. But we think of carbon sequestration, which is the taking in of that carbon, the storing in the wood that is a really long-term place to keep that carbon. And indeed, even when we harvest trees, that carbon may not be released. If we think about it, it gets used for lumber, gets made into a piece of furniture, a house. That carbon is stored in that piece of lumber for a very long time. And so it's incredibly important for global climate change, for processes, and that's why it's vital that we keep forest cover throughout the world, not just here in Vermont.
We did hear from Sue on Facebook, and she found a tree and wrote to us and said, this old maple, she took a picture of it, is in the woods on the backside of Willoughby Lake. I listened to your Brave Little State podcast about old growth forests. I think this old girl is pretty old, and she estimated that this tree was 300 years old. Now, do we have trees as old as 300 years old in Vermont? Older, Michael?
Yes. There are so maples, yellow birch, red spruce. These are trees that will live 300 or 400 years if we let them. That said, there aren't very many. That's what the podcast, the Brave Little State podcast, explored, where there stands of old groups of old trees together. We certainly have individual trees of that age throughout the state. Many we know, many we don't know, and far fewer though. Woods, old woods, or as Angela referred to them as elderly woods, which I really like.
Now, I know you just mentioned the yellow birch, and I know silviculturists don't play favorites, but you are a big fan of the yellow birch. Please explain why.
Well, yeah, it's there's so many. There's much to love about all these trees, and I do. But when pressed, and I guess I'm being pressed, I'll admit to a certain fondness for yellow birch. It's we don't have enough time, but I would say the tree itself is just plain beautiful in all of its over the course of its age of its life, the various ages. It takes different shapes and colors and forms. It captures light. The yellow papery bark is phenomenal. Where it grows, what it grows with, the twigs smell like wintergreen and taste like wintergreen, the fresh growth. It's preferentially sought out by forest songbirds as a place to forage and hunt for food. And that we haven't even gotten to like my beautiful kitchen cabinets that are made from yellow birch and how amazing it is. And on it goes. Where it grows, how it grows, what it looks like, and what it does for us, it's a powerful combination. And again, the big lunkers, 400 years is not out of the question.
Allie, is there a tree that you particularly admire, a species?
Well, I'm also a huge yellow birch fan. For my favorite deciduous, see, I would have to break it down by type of tree. Favorite conifer would be the eastern hemlock. I am a big fan of the really, you know, the trees that can persist in our forest for a long time. So yellow birch and hemlock are old trees. They can persist and wait for that gap in the canopy and take advantage of it. And they provide a lot of important habitat, food. Mama bears use the hemlock as a nurse tree. They'll put their cubs up in there while they go forage. There's incredible properties of both those trees.
And does the hemlock have to worry about the advance of the hemlock-related algae?
Yep, that is our biggest threat here. And right now, it is being controlled by our cold winter temperatures. So when we have really cold snaps, I know lots of people don't like those, but that is great for the for the hemlock-related algae. It really knocks the population down. So we do have hemlock-related algae in southern Vermont and in surrounding states. So it is a big threat for the hemlock, and it has wiped out some areas of hemlock. But there is good news in that there is some natural resistance to hemlock-woolly adelgid, and it has to do with the physiology of certain trees. They produce chemicals that can help prevent the little adelgid insects from eating the needles. So more stay tuned on that. People are researching exactly what that mechanism is, but there are some surviving hemlock in places that it's been decimated.
Well, from invasive insects, let's talk about invasive trees. Terry is calling from Brandon. Hi, Terry. What's your question?
Hi. Thank you so much. We have all heard about invasive plants in the state of Vermont. Some are worse than others. I'm wondering if there are invasive species of trees that should be culled from a woodlot.
That's a great question. We also got this from George. He emailed. He's in Northfield and says, we have a single buckthorn in the backyard. It's beautiful, but I've learned that they're invasive and possibly harmful to wildlife. Should I remove it? So let's talk about invasive trees. What invasive trees do we have here? What kind of threats do they pose?
Sure. As the caller said, we tend to hear a lot about invasive plants generally, but I think that's mostly focused on herbaceous species and many shrub species, woody shrubs. There are some invasive that would include the buckthorn, so I'll cover that. Buckthorn is a very pernicious, invasive, non-native shrub, woody shrub that outcompetes natives, and your best hope is to get it early before it takes over. So in that case, without anything else to go on, I would recommend the removal. It's not so much harmful for wildlife, it just doesn't really do them any good. And in that way, it's kind of like junk food. The fruits that they produce that are eaten, they don't really have any value. So it can be harmful in that way.
They're like the Cheetos of the, forest. Anything else on these trees?
Yep, and we do have some invasive tree species. So Norway maple is a really common one we see. It was planted a lot as a street tree before we realized that it was problematic, but it now is seeding into woods adjacent to where it's growing. So we often see it more in towns and cities. And one way to identify it looks a lot like a sugar maple. The leaf is a little wider, but if you pull off the leaf, the little stem will exude a milky sap. And so that's a really good indicator that you probably have Norway maple. And that's not to say it doesn't provide some services like shade or erosion control. So you have to think about removing it carefully and replacing it with something else.
All right, let's go back to the calls. And Windsor we go to this time for Michael. Michael, what's your question?
Hello. Hi. It's about the American elm issue. I assume that the American elm was planted in communities originally because of its face-shaped growth pattern, and it formed kind of nice tunnels all over the streets. But there's another tree, its cousin, hackberry, that does the same thing. Why don't we just replace the dead elms with hackberries, which really don't have any problems except maybe for a witch's broom, which is not a big issue. So is anyone considering using hackberry to replace the dead elms?
Excellent question. Ali Kusiba?
Yes, places do have hackberry, actually. At the UVM campus, a lot of the street trees are hackberry. One interesting thing is that lowland trees, so trees that grow in kind of not in mountains, but in areas that may be more floodplains, are actually great for street trees because they've been adapted to compact soils that happen when you have low oxygen. So you think about how harsh it is to grow in a town or a city where there's lots of pavement, where people might trample your roots. You have to be a very hardy tree. So not every tree is good to grow in a city. One thing I would advocate is that we don't want to take out all the elms or the ashes and replace them with one species. We want a diversity of species in our cities and our towns and really in our forests. So that's critical for preventing these widespread die-offs, so we can see. We don't know if an insect will come in from another country that will affect hackberry. So keeping diversity is number one.
We've been talking about street trees here. What stresses do those trees that are right along our roads have to kind of shoulder and burden? And what can we do, Michael, to help those trees in particular?
They're so important. They provide so much, these green places where we live and the built environment, and yet it is really tough. They are basically, if you can think of it, they're up against everything. Then I think last I heard in the something like 7 to 11 years would be the expected lifespan of a street tree, because it's so tough out there. There's just endless assaults, compaction, chemicals from pollution from automobile runoff, exhausts. So poor air quality. Chemicals in the water, compaction, people doing horrible things to trees by tying things to them or pulling them apart, banging into them, on and on it goes. Yet we have some species, as Ali said, that are kind of adapted to putting up with those difficult conditions. And that's what urban and community forestry professionals really thrive on and focus on, is how to have these green places in our built environments in a way that lasts. And they've made great strides. They are up against an enormous array of assaults on their health. And it's a tough environment. There are better choices to make and better care that can be given. And we're seeing, I think that's been a real shift over the last couple decades in our understanding and care of street trees.
Ali, let's go up to the crown of the tree. Why don't we just have a tangled mess of branches up there?
It's a great question. I've seen some beautiful aerial imagery of forests or woods from the top, and you see that each tree's crown is a little bit separate from the neighboring tree's crown, and we have a term for that. It's called crown shyness, which I love that term. And really, it's just a resource competition issue. So really, those trees are trying to grow up and straight. This is what makes a tree a tree. It has this woody trunk, and the purpose is to get its branches and its leaves as high as possible. So it doesn't really have a need to be shaded. It wants to be in the full sun. So competing with another tree just makes that tree grow up and more into the sun, where the resources are the most prevalent. And it's pulling up water, nutrients from the soil, and doing the photosynthesis in its leaves, where the sun is most prevalent.
All right, let's talk about something called shade tolerance, Michael, because some trees need copious sunlight while others get by on less. So why and what trees are need all that sun, and what can get by with a little less?
You said a great thing there with get by with. Let's begin with the premise. They all want ample sunshine, water, and nutrients. They all grow much better if they have everything they need. Tolerance is a general term in forest ecology to describe how trees deal with shortages of one needed item or another, like sunlight. Some trees are able to get by, as you say, with less sunlight. We refer to that as being highly shade tolerant or tolerant of shade, which simply means they are able to photosynthesize, to capture sunlight and turn it into take the carbon dioxide and with the energy of the sun, water, and nutrients, and make wood, as Ali described, and tree parts. They can do that in low light levels. They're just highly efficient at low light levels. That's one of the great things about these forests filled with these trees that are all different. They're all different. They are adapted and built differently. They have the same basic concept, but they fill different niches, and they exploit different possibilities. And some are just tolerant of extremes. So an eastern hemlock, Ali's favorite conifer, can live under its own shade or that of others and thrive for decades, and then respond to a break in the canopy when there's new light and actually kind of have a resurgence of growth. American beech would be the poster child for shade tolerance among hardwoods. It can thrive in an understory. Sugar maple's quite shade tolerant as well. White pine, trembling aspen, white birch, these are intolerant of shade, and they can't compete as well, because they're not able to photosynthesize as efficiently under low light levels.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. And today it's all about the lives of trees, not just the forests, the big masses, but we're getting to the granular level, learning about the trees themselves. Michael Snyder is here. He's commissioner of Vermont's Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation. He has a new book. It's called Woods Wise, An Exploration of Forests and Forestry. Also, Alexandra Kasiba is a research project coordinator for the Forest Ecosystem Monitoring Cooperative. And let's talk to Fred, who's calling from Rutland. Hi, Fred. What's your question today?
I was wondering, the sycamore, is that one of the older trees? Like in Rutland, they had what you used to call the Sycamore Inn on South Main Street, and that tree's been there for decades and decades and decades, probably centuries.
How old are sycamores, some of the older trees we'd have here?
You know, Allie, do you have a good sense of this? It's such a, it's not a particularly common tree. It's common in Vermont, I guess I could also say. I mean, in certain places, the rivers, edges, et cetera, is where we really think of it. Honestly, I'm going to plead that I don't know its life history on this one. I'm guessing it's probably mid-range, a couple hundred years probably, easy, and they can often grow to these enormous sizes with that wonderful mottled bark. They're a real treasure.
A couple hundred years, not too shabby.
No, it's really not. That's when we say only a couple hundred, you know we're onto something.
All right. We did hear from John in Montpelier, and John says, this year, Central Vermont has a big crop of serviceberries. I love them, but I'm happy to share with the birds who usually get to them first anyway. Serviceberries. Somebody help me here. Go ahead, Allie.
Yep. Great woodland species that we have. It produces this kind of blueberry looking like berry, but it also has a beautiful flower in the spring. I love them. They'll be peppered throughout the woods and you'll see kind of this splash of white in the woods. Very early flower. It's a great small tree. Doesn't grow to be a huge canopy tree, but incredibly important to that structural diversity. That's a term I'll throw out, which means in the forest, we don't want just one level of the canopy, that all the trees are the same height. We want herbaceous plants, so on the ground floor, but we also want shrubs. We also want small trees. We want trees regenerating. This provides a forest that will be our future forest, right? So if a tree falls down in a windstorm, there's something that can take its spot, but it also provides habitat and cover for birds and insects, all sorts of life. It does a lot for cycling of water, more carbon storage, as we've talked about. And we didn't talk about the fact that forests release oxygen, too. That is, yeah, is pivotal for us as humans and for the world to exist as it does.
Well, you brought up the insects, the birds, the wildlife that all utilize our trees. So, Michael, why don't you explain how some of that is happening that we don't see every day just looking into the woods?
Right. Some we do. You see, birders are out there in the woods looking for little warblers among the leaves, and we see them. But this is a great point, is that especially when you consider Allie's point about the complex structure of healthy forests, there's all these different sizes and spacings and distribution and arrangement of the trees. That's this enormous space of life. So we look at eye level at the stem, and you might see some caterpillars crawling on a stem or what have you, or a woodpecker drilling into it. But when you look up in the canopy, there's the obvious songbirds, but there are dozens, hundreds, thousands, probably more organisms on every tree, from the charismatic, songbirds down to insects of a vast array of insects, mites, spiders, liverworts, microbes, fungi, on and on. The amount of life in the more sort of surface area and spaces and environments within a forest that you have, and think all the way to the canopy, that's a lot of opportunity for life, and life takes advantage of it in an amazing array.
If I was a wild crafter, I would have mentioned fungi, so mm-hmm. What's going on there with all those?
I love fungi. And thinking about how they're related to our trees and our forests and their importance is a really interesting dynamic. So a lot of the edible mushrooms that people like and love to harvest, like morels and chanterelles, they have a symbiotic relationship with trees. So people that forage for mushrooms will know to look under a certain species like elms for morels. And that's because they're related to the tree root network. So they help provide more surface area on those tree roots, basically. So the underground mushroom, which is where the bulk of the mushroom is, what we pick is just the fruit, is helping get more water, get more minerals from the soil. And then in return, the tree will give the mushroom some carbohydrates and sugars. So it's this lovely relationship. And it really is vital for health of trees and ecosystems, especially in times of stress.
I think we have time for one more call. Let's talk to Gino, who's calling from Putney. Hi, Gino. What's your question?
Good. Hi. Hope you can hear me.
We can, yeah.
I'm wondering about certain invasive vines. You talked about plants and invasive trees, but these things climb trees, and especially at the edge of forests where there's sunshine, like along our highways. So one of them is this oriental bittersweet, which is, not wanted by anyone around here. Another one is the hardy kiwi. I've heard that can also climb and damage trees, but I haven't heard about that being in Vermont, being a problem in Vermont. I planted some for food. They're like kiwis to eat. But anyway, so I'm wondering about either of those, how big a problem are we on a ticking time bomb with like the bittersweet or maybe even kiwi?
All right, Gino, let me get an answer for you on invasive vines. Who knows about that?
I can talk to that a little bit,
good.
I guess.
All right, Allie,
so, yes, I think that is a really good observation, because as we have these vines climb up trees, they can actually knock the trees over. They smother them too. So we can have some pretty catastrophic events that happen. I did a lot of work in the Pacific Northwest where English ivy is a problem, and it does that exact same thing. And I painstakingly chopped out ivy stems to remove them and save trees. It probably would be warranted for bittersweet. I haven't heard about hardy kiwi being invasive yet, although I know that's a worry. But it is true that we see this problem more in disturbed forests. So if we think about our intact forests where we really don't have invasive species, a lot of those processes are better and the trees are able to grow fine. And what we see is those medians along highways is where we see that problem, probably because those forests and those trees are stressed and that invasive is able to take over.
Mm. We got this from Robert in North Ferrisburg. Michael, he's looking for a little advice. He has a large, roughly 24-inch diameter shagbark hickory, which has been dropping a lot of leaves for the past 2 years or so. Some are still green when they fall, and many are dying on their branches before falling. Any idea what this is?
Hard to say from here, from that description. It could be any number of abiotic factors, that is non-living kind of drivers of some sort of mechanical injury or disruption to the soil or root system somehow. It could be a fungal disease, some sort of pathogen. And I think, not having the benefit of looking at it, I would recommend that he
Robert.
A call to the Addison County Forester, Chris Olson, and he'd be a great portal to have a look at it. Maybe bring in some other professionals if need be, but give good solid guidance.
All right, and I want to finish with this comment that we got from Mark on Facebook. It says the world would be a much better place if every day more of us built a conscious relationship with trees. I planted a sugar maple some 15 years ago. When it was much smaller, today it provides my backyard with not only shade, but tons of joy and satisfaction. And as we mentioned earlier, Oxygen Baby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a great story?
It sure is. And everyone needs to listen and do it, because especially on the shade thing, you think, well, it's never going to grow up to be shade. It's amazing how fast a sapling that you can pull up somewhere in the woods and stick in the ground, it's amazing how fast it will be providing actual shade. Don't give up on it. Get out there and plant those trees and have the same experience.
That's Michael Snyder. He's commissioner of Vermont's Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation. He has a new book out. It's called Woodswise, An Exploration of Forests and Forestry. Also, Alexandra Kasiba is a research project coordinator for the Forest Ecosystem Monitoring Cooperative. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Rick.